It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Opposition appears to be growing to the idea of allowing a shooting range and an area for all-terrain vehicles at what used to be a large ammunition plant near Baraboo.
This week, Chuck Quernbach tagged along with about 50 people on the tour of the former Badger ammo site, and he has this report.
Badger helped fuel what some call the arsenal of democracy for three wars, from World War II through Vietnam. But most of the plant's many production buildings have been torn down in the last few years. A sizable exception is here at some concrete bunkers near the center of the 7,200-acre Badger site. DNR property manager Ryder Will told the DNR board and about 30 local citizens that nitroglycerin was used and made in the partially buried bunkers.
To protect the infrastructure and the other workers, if there were to be an accident or an explosion in one, the idea behind burying them in like this was to confine that explosion and that damage to that one particular area.
DNR upper managers recently lit a fuse under a land use issue at Badger as the agency works on a master plan for the roughly 3,400 acres the DNR is expected to take over once soil cleanup work is completed. The DNR says one option that it's considering is to add a shooting range and ATV track on part of the planned Sauk Prairie Recreation Area. Scott Gunderson is DNR Assistant Deputy Secretary and a Scott Walker appointee. Gunderson says there's a need for ATV trails in southern Wisconsin and for a shooting range on public land.
We know that more firearms and ammo's being sold here in the last 5 years than ever in the history of this country. So I think it's important to have just safe, accessible places for our citizens to be able to go and exercise their recreational rights to shoot a firearm.
But Gunderson's view appears to be running into more opposition, including from some hunters. Don Hamas of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation says his group has recently gone on record against the shooting range and ATVs.
It's a very important location for migrating songbirds and also for nesting and breeding purposes. And so when you put all of that together, it's just really inappropriate.
Democratic State Senator John Erpenbach represents the area around Badger. He says he hopes the DNR board realizes that firing guns and allowing buzzing ATVs would go against a land division deal for Badger reached a dozen years ago.
I think the board has a responsibility to first work from the agreement that we've had from a while ago, which is only low impact, which does not include a shooting range or ATV trails, which under, I think, any definition of the word impact would be considered high impact.
And it's that potential high impact on the land that has relaunched what has been a 25-year debate at Badger over potential soil and water contamination from some of the old weapons chemicals. Joan Kenny, representing the Army, told the DNR board the contaminants are almost under control.
And we've been doing environmental cleanup bit by bit, because like any elephant, you have to eat them bite by bite. And it's taken us 10 years, but we're almost done chewing.
Laura Olov, Citizens for Safe Water around Badger, says much of the land and water at or near the old plant appear to be cleaner. But she says the DNR may be underestimating the risk to public and animal health if ATVs start ripping up the ground.
The Army based their cleanup levels on the DNR's application to the National Park Services and those uses listed in that application. They were all low impact.
In the last few days, the USDA, which uses about 2,000 acres at Badger, has come out against the shooting range and ATVs. So have some local governments near the former plant. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Chuck. We hear from the DNR that the Badger plant land will be open for self-guided auto tours on August 24th. There will be a public comment period running through August 30th. Well, coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about a new UW-Madison study on lead exposure, but first, a look at the decline of juries.
There are a lot of cases that go through our legal system, but not many of them go before juries. Our next guest says that's a problem.
And you can weigh in. Do you think juries are important? Have you served on one? Were you glad you did, or did you find it an annoyance? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org.
Albert DeZur joins us now. He's a professor of political science and philosophy at Bowling Green State University and author of Punishment, Participatory Democracy, and the Jury. He wrote a new article on juries called 12 Absent Men. Albert, thanks and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Sure. Well, when I think about a court case in this country, what pops into my mind is a dramatic legal showdown in front of a jury. How far from reality am I?
You're pretty far from reality. most cases are settled before they even go to trial. Something like 1 to 4% of all criminal cases at the state and federal level go on to that sort of dramatic scene that we see on television all the time. Hmm. So it's a pretty small number.
What's driving that shift? Why is there a decline?
Well, it's complicated. The famous author Alexis de Tocqueville came over here in the 1830s and wrote about democracy in America. And one of the institutions that he thought symbolized the American system was the jury. And he was amazed at how participatory the legal system was. And at the time of his visit, of course, something like 90% of cases were being heard by a jury trial. That steadily decreased over the course of the 19th century as judges began to argue that they were the best safeguards of individual liberties because they had the professional knowledge and the education and so on. And so by the late 19th century, early 20th century, plea bargains and other sorts of negotiated settlements were the dominant way of resolving civil and criminal cases in the American legal system. So we moved pretty far away from the participatory system that Tocqueville celebrated in Democracy in America to a much more professional-dominated, behind-the-scenes institutional process. And I think we've suffered because of that.
Yeah, well, let's get into that in a little bit. I do want to ask, though, because some people talk about being summoned for jury duty as though it's some sort of crime in itself that they don't want to have to do, and or that it's a punishment, I should say. But do you think that people see this as something that is just a little bit too overwhelming to hold someone's fate in their own hands?
You know, that's a really good question. Okay, and my first reaction is, what novel did you bring in the waiting room? It was probably a mystery, what TV show were you eager to get back to after going in, for jury service? It was Law and Order. So sort of our fantasy life, is very active. And we can't wait to figure out the details that will, prove who did it. But then, are we going to go on that trip in real life? We're reluctant to do that. And I actually think it's because we're out of practice. We haven't been called to serve enough. We haven't shouldered enough of this sort of civic responsibility for criminal justice. And that's what's behind this reluctance. There's been some interesting empirical work, actually, on jury service that shows that, oddly enough, the more complicated and demanding the criminal trial, the more jurors feel like it was really worth it, that their time was well spent. And it's the jury service that winds up with, you go in and you're not impaneled, or you go in and it's a really quick case. That's the service that people tend to, find less rewarding. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, it becomes a puzzle to solve, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
More of an intellectual pursuit. Well, let's dig into what you had alluded to before. What do we as a citizenry gain from by having jury trials?
Okay. Well, I'm going to answer. I mean, as a typical academic, I'm going to answer that sort of in a lopsided way.
Okay.
Okay. So the simple answer is, what do we gain? We gain a kind of moral awareness of the world of crime and punishment, the real world of crime and punishment, not law and order. And you know, then you can ask, well, why is that moral awareness valuable? And I think it's valuable because we are in the midst of a punishment bonanza that I think hardly ever breaks through public consciousness. One of my favorite writers about punishment is a Norwegian criminal justice scholar by the name of Nils Christie. And Nils Christie calls the United States the world champion of incarceration. We lead the world in the percentage of citizens incarcerated. This is the land of the free. You know, this is the country that celebrates individual liberties, and yet we have so many of our fellow citizens in this prison system. And so I think that one of the antidotes to that is this kind of awareness of who is going behind bars, you know, mm-hmm. and the sort of proximity to real people that a jury trial brings is necessary for us to get a full picture of the sort of carceral system that we've been developing for the past generation.
We're talking to Bowling Green political scientist Albert DeZur about the decline of juries in the United States.
You can join in. Do you agree that we should have more trials go before juries? Are they an important part of our participatory government? And do we learn more about the legal system? Did you, if you were on a jury? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
Thanks, Noah. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
We continue our conversation with Albert DeZur, author of Punishment, Participatory Democracy, and the Jury, talking about his piece, 12 Absent Men, in the Boston Review, The Decline of the Jury and What It Means for Us. We've got that linked, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page.
You can join in. Do you think juries still matter? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. Let's go right to the phones and talk to Scott in Ashland. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your question or comment?
I just had a quick comment. I think the lack of jury selection or juries nowadays is probably due to law enforcement officers doing a better job getting evidence, whether video, audio, confessions, give people less reason to contest whatever they were charged with. And secondly, if there was a jury trial, that is very expensive for whatever county it happens to be. To call a jury, I'd say around $1,000 a day to have the jury come in and hear the trial. So it's better for the county to settle the case than go to trial. So that's mm-hmm. all I have to say. Thank you.
All right. What do you think about that, Albert?
There's something to that. I would say, though, as for the first point about law enforcement doing a better job, the decline really happened, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when you really didn't have the kinds of sophisticated law enforcement evidence gathering techniques that we see today. So that's, I agree with what he says. But that's probably not the reason for the decline. The cost of jury trials is a big issue. So if you ask police officers or prosecutors, judges, why there aren't more trials, it always comes down to cost. You know, we couldn't possibly, you know, we couldn't possibly afford to do more than we do now. And I guess I think that that's bogus, because really what we're talking about is a very narrow understanding of cost, okay? And what I'm pushing for in the book and in this Boston Review essay is a larger understanding of cost, okay? What is the cost of being, again, this term, the world champion incarcerator? I think we're not even, I don't think we've begun to be aware of the social, political, moral, and economic cost of having so many people behind bars. And so anything that allows us to have more awareness of the criminal justice process, I think, will help us understand some of these other costs, right? So jury trial, okay, that's a short-term cost. Incarceration, that's a huge long-term cost that we're barely aware of. So I'm a little skeptical of the cost argument.
Let's talk next to Chuck in Sun Prairie. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What's your question?
Good. Well, I have two comments to make. The first one is, I think trials have gotten so technical that I think we should have professional jurors, you know, people who do for a living, because things have gotten so technical that I know that some people get in there and they don't have a clue what's going on during the trial. And second of all, I have been selected three times for jury duty, and every time I got in there and I got picked, the lawyer has bounced me off. You know, they sit there like, oh, I don't want juror number one, and I don't want juror number two. And it's kind of disheartening because everybody that was there that day, nobody wanted to be there. And I was the only one that was excited about being picked as a juror. And then when I got bounced off, it was like, well, just because this lawyer doesn't want me, I don't get to be on the case. And it's kind of disheartening. And it makes people like myself like, I'm not going through this again. I'm not going to go be picked all day, sit there all day, wait to be picked, and then told to go home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a big waste of time. So that's why people are, I think, discouraged and said, I don't ever want to be picked again.
Albert, let's tackle that first point that he brings up. Should juries be somehow professionalized, and what would be the impact of that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, in Tocqueville's time, you know, when more Americans served on the jury and there were more jury trials, you would have a jury impaneled for a number of days and hear more than one case. And so you could say that, that earlier model was one where jurors were more seasoned, you know, as to how trials worked and what sorts of legal concepts to be attuned to and so on. But Chuck's point has to do with the technical nature of the evidence or the law in question. And you know, there are models for dealing with that in some European countries. You have panels where there are lay judges, and so in addition to like a regular judge, you have two or three lay people who also have some degree of training, and they serve for, you know, a duration of a year or two in that position. I personally don't think that that's like the best model for us, because I think that that does not serve the goal of having more Americans, you know, involved in the criminal justice process, which is, I think, what we need. But it could be that for some kinds of cases, you know, that sort of lay magistrate system might be useful.
And in our last 30 seconds, what will it take to bring juries back?
I think some awareness of the kinds of costs that we are currently paying for mass incarceration. That's what I think that has to be, and some awareness of what we can do as citizens to have a more responsible legal system.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us about that.
It's my pleasure.
That was Albert DeZoor. He's professor of political science and philosophy at Bowling Green. We have a link to his article on juries on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, does lead exposure affect kids' behavior in school? A new UW study tried to find out. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to an online mom who shares great videos for kids.
But first, we're talking to the author of a study about the effects of lead on children. The study found kids who are exposed to lead are almost three times more likely to be suspended from school by the fourth grade than those who aren't.
The study's authors say kids who are suspended are at a greater risk for dropping out of school, twice as likely to use tobacco, more likely to engage in violent behavior later in life.
Mike Amato joins us now. He's a doctoral candidate in psychology at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. He's the lead author of this study. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what were you examining in the study exactly?
So in this study, we wanted to look at the relationship between exposure to lead when a child is an infant in the first 2 years of life and the likelihood that they get suspended later on in the fourth grade. So we looked at a sample of about 3,000 students, all in Milwaukee, and we used a public health database here from the state Department of Health that has the records of those blood lead tests, and we categorized kids into two groups, one group who had been exposed and another group who we considered not exposed. And then we compared suspension rates for those kids in the fourth grade, and what we found was that students in the exposed group were about three times more likely to be suspended than kids in the unexposed group. Now, a big challenge in this kind of research is disentangling the influence of multiple factors. So then we put into the statistical model factors accounting for the effects of income, race, and gender on suspension rates, and even adjusting for all of those other factors, led still the kids in the exposed group were still about twice as likely to be suspended.
Why is that? Can you talk about what lead is doing to a child?
Yeah, so lead affects the way a child's brain develops. The body thinks that lead is calcium because they're chemically similar. So when kids are growing, when a healthy, unexposed child would be packing their bones full of calcium, children who are exposed to lead are packing lead into their bones, and that lead stays there for their whole life. And it also affects the way the brain is getting wired. Calcium has an important role to play in the development of a healthy brain. So we know from animal experiments, that the way lead affects the brain has influences on behavior that lead to decreased attention, decreased cognitive ability, greater reactivity to startling stimuli, all things that would lead to behaviors that might cause a child to get suspended in school. And so that's why we wanted to do this study and actually measure what is the real effect of students in the classroom.
And you also say that getting suspended in school has lifelong impacts. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. So getting suspended is bad news for that kid the day that it happens because it means they're in trouble. But it's also bad news over the course of their whole life because there's a lot of studies that show that students who are suspended, even when you account for other risk factors, are more likely to drop out of school than kids who never become suspended. They're also more likely to engage in violent behavior, more likely to begin smoking. all of those sort of what we could call medium-term outcomes, you know, things that happen in the adolescent years, then go on to cascade later on in life. You know, you could imagine a kid who doesn't graduate from high school is going to have a lot more difficult of a time finding meaningful employment after they graduate. And we know that employment level and education level are correlated with public health outcomes, even into old age. So lead is something that is right at the sort of the beginning of a long causal chain of events that affect a kid over their whole life.
Can you talk a little bit about the demographics of the two groups you talked about? You said that you had two groups of children, one that you would consider exposed to lead and one that was not. Were there any demographic differences between these two groups?
Yeah, there definitely were. So first, I should also say that we were only looking at kids who were at somewhat of a moderate level of exposure. So all of the kids in our sample were not above the threshold at which the state of Wisconsin mandates that some sort of intervention happens, right? So no one in this sample was acutely exposed. We were just looking at kids who were moderately exposed and those who weren't. And those in the moderately exposed group were much more likely to be African-American than white, you know, and that's a pattern that is seen nationally as well as here in our sample. So one of the things we were interested in is what sort of role might lead be playing in the achievement gap, right? Which is a topic that's gotten a lot of public attention lately. You know, when you see a statistic about, you know, here in Madison, the black students do more poorly on standardized tests than white students. It's a descriptive statistic that tells you there's a big problem, and everybody agrees that that is a big problem that is bad for society and especially bad for those kids who are affected. But that doesn't say what the cause is. And, you know, to really make to improve on that, we need to understand what the causes are so that we can find solutions to them. And lead obviously isn't the sole cause, but I think it is definitely part of the picture. And so these kids who are exposed are not getting a fair shot at life. You know, the first day they show up in a classroom, they're at a disadvantage, and those effects stick with them for their whole lives.
So a couple of questions then, maybe some takeaways for our audience. First of all, for people who are currently exposed to lead, even if moderately exposed, what options do they have for removing it from their environment?
Lead is a pretty insidious toxin because once you are exposed, the effects are permanent and there's no going back. And now, you know, many people who are exposed in childhood go on to lead happy, productive lives, but, you know, we'll never know what they might have achieved had that not happened. What's most important is primary prevention, preventing kids from getting exposed in the first place. And so anyone who has small children or large children, or even if you don't have children, because it's not good for adults either, but people should definitely know whether there's lead in their home. And so any homes built before 1980 are, you know, you should probably do a test. You know, the Department of Health Services website has a great page that has a lot of information people can look at. There's some useful videos and resources there. There are some strips that people can buy that I think 3M makes that it's about $20 for a kit that people can swab their walls and it gives them a rough test of whether there's lead there. So people should get their, you know, the paint in their homes, and also the dust, because dust is a big pathway that kids get exposed through. You know, there's this idea that children are sitting in corners eating paint chips, and I don't know how true that is, but I think dust from homes that have lead in them and old window sashes, that gets in the air and kids breathe it and get exposed that way. Similarly, soil. You know, if somebody has a yard where they're going to be doing some backyard gardening, or even if they've got a spot in the yard where kids like to play and what kids don't like to play in the yard, people should take a sample of their soil and mail it into the state lab and get that analyzed and find out, you know, what is the level of lead in the soil.
Hmm. This might be a very elementary question. Is lead a naturally occurring chemical in soil or element of soil?
It's a good question. Lead is an element, mm-hmm. and we've got, you know, lots of it here in Wisconsin. That's what miners were coming for. But almost all of the lead that's in our urban and also rural environments where people live is put there by humans, gotcha. Right? The two main sources were paint from before it was banned in the 70s and car exhaust.
Mm-hmm. So where will this research lead you next? What are you going to take a look at now?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that me and some of my co-authors are interested in is what can be done to help remove lead from the environment, right? We know that lead is a problem, and this study, I think, goes into a new domain and shows that lead is not just a public health problem, but it's also a problem for education. That, you know, if we really want to eliminate the achievement gap, which I think people pretty universally agree is something we should do, we are going to need to remove lead from people's houses. There's pretty big agreement on that. But the question of what people should do, sometimes it's a little tough, you know. So we've got a bunch of ideas. One is putting together resources to streamline the process and make it really easy for people to know what to do. Another thing is looking at just how much of the exposure that the kids are getting now is coming from lead paint that has lead in it in houses, and how much is coming from soil in the yards. Mm-hmm. And there's a surprising amount of uncertainty about that.
Well, we will stay tuned for more. Thank you so much, Mike.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
That was Mike Amato, a doctoral candidate in psychology at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison.
Coming up next, we'll talk to a mom who started a project curating cool videos online for kids, parents, and teachers. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. Thanks, Noah. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Our next guest found herself digging up cool videos online for her kids about nature, culture, science, and more. She turned that into an ongoing web project to curate interesting things for kids, parents, and teachers.
Ryan Nakaya is with us now. Her website is The Kid Should See This. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start by giving a listen to one of the videos that helped start your project. This is Ella Fitzgerald doing some of that scat singing. Ryan, you watched that video with your kids. How did they react?
Well, I'm really happy that you played that video because it was really magical as far as an experience for us. My son, later in the week, I overheard him scatting, and that was such an exciting moment for me. And I thought, of course, it would be so wonderful if every kid and every adult could enjoy Ella Fitzgerald scatting as much as my kid did.
Well, how did that get you started on the road to making The Kid Should See This website?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I watched Jacques Cousteau specials, and I was, you know, fortunate enough to see Baryshnikov ballet on TV. Of course, there was Sesame Street and Reading Rainbow and things like that. And so when I became a parent, I started looking for similar types of content. And unfortunately, with obvious exceptions, on television, you don't always find everything you're looking for as far as educational stuff. And so since I've been blogging in some format since about 1999, you know, and as a design director for interactive projects, I'm constantly online. And so it's pretty natural for me to look for content there. I'm often Googling my kids' questions when I don't have the proper scientific answer or something like that. And so I really, after that Ella video and that experience, I went to Tumblr and I set up a blog. I bought a URL and I started collecting all of the stuff there. And it's really been amazing. We've gotten such a wonderful response from teachers, from other parents who are looking for alternative types of content to share with their kids, and really to help start a conversation and learn themselves, which has been great.
The internet is huge, and you've kind of made yourself one of the curators of this. What kind of content makes the cut, makes you say the kids should see this?
Well, you know, it's stuff that ranges from science to art to, just fun little moments. We love to see how things are made. We love that, wow moment whenever I find something online. It's like you said, the internet is huge. There is almost a renaissance of wonderful videos that are being made by content creators. There's TED Ed and PBS work and all of this wonderful stuff. And so just to be able to bring it to one spot and when you have that aha moment, and when I'm learning something, and when my kids are responding to it in a positive way, that's when it goes on the blog.
You know, I was thinking about this Ella Fitzgerald cut, and then I was looking at your website today. You have a video of Chico Marx up there.
Mm-hmm. What
is it that keeps kids engaged? Maybe it's just a stereotype on my part, but I figure kids look at black and white video and they think, man, that's boring. But what is it that sparks their interest?
I think that when it's something that a parent or a teacher has enthusiasm for, that's a huge part of it. And I think that it's maybe an association with other black and white videos that they've seen that maybe they haven't been as interested in. All of the videos that we put on there, they're pre-tested, they're kid tested, and they really respond well to it. And there's always some little humor or something that maybe makes them feel like, oh, I should try that. I want to do that. And I think that that's been another huge goal for us. It's not only don't underestimate kids and what they might learn or what they might be interested in, but it's also, looking for ways to extend that conversation or that experience offline too. It might be a maker project, or it might be, playing an instrument, or just trying different things, starting that conversation.
You focus
and really having kind of a shared vocabulary between parents and teachers and kids, so that you can continue that forth hands-on.
Ryan, as your kids are growing older, you've been showing them content. Have you started to encourage them to create their own web content?
I haven't encouraged them to create their own web content, but like I said, it's really important for us to take things offline after we watch something. We have limited screen time, I think being able to find the videos quickly and easy on our blog is really important for that. And then, how does that conversation go on? My son wanted me to share that he loves Rube Goldberg machines and that he loves trying to build them. How can we make this long contraption of reactions to do this really simple thing, little marble machines and things like that. And that kind of trial and error and experimentation, either with science and physics or maybe art, taking it outside into nature and exploring insects or anything like that. I think that's really where our excitement has been coming from.
You focus mostly on videos made for grown-ups instead of kid videos. Why is that?
I want to share content that appeals to both kids and adults alike. Like I said, I don't want to underestimate kids. I think that some made-for-kids content it can dumb it down for kids. Either there's zany narrators or guitar riffs or wacky sound effects on animal videos or something like that. And I really try to avoid those. I think it wastes everybody's time. And in addition, I think that if we can all learn together, if this is a video that inspires or educates me as an adult, then that experience, that excitement of learning, that not only is really inspiring for me and gets me going, but I think that's a great example for my children that I'm a lifelong learner.
that love of lifelong learning actually is what first caught my interest about the show. And so much of what you said sounds like when we were pitching this new show on Wisconsin Public Radio, that we're exploring all these different ideas. Do you see that spark going in your kids? Do you think they're going to take this and run with it, you know, through their school years into adulthood?
Well, we are very lucky that so far we've been hearing good reports from school. There's always interest in trying new projects, doing new things, being interested in learning. I really hope that that continues. And so far, it's been really fun. But being that I have so much enthusiasm for learning and getting that aha moment, you know, I'm hoping and expecting that just that example is going to be passed on to my kids.
What's one of the favorite things you've added to the website lately?
Well, we have so many things. You know, we have a whole group of videos that show how musical instruments are made, and I think that's terribly fascinating. We have one about pianos being made. We have a recent video from Wired magazine that goes inside the Tesla factory here in California. You know, and that's always great when you see big robot arms putting together something in a factory. You know, we have a tour of the moon that is pretty incredible, all of the different satellites around the moon and different planets that show things that we would never be able to see with our own eyes. All of those things have been really great.
Great. Ryan, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much.
That was Ryan Nakaya. Her website is The Kids Should See This. We'll throw a link on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about a DNR public hearing on the proposed iron mine site in Iron and Ashland counties.
You can hear that a live stream of that event tomorrow morning starting at 10. We'll also look at a new effort to preserve the sounds of America. That's tomorrow on Central Time.